Good morning, everybody. That was kind of weak for the first day of a conference, so let's just pretend that didn't happen and start over. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
That's much better. That's what I like to hear. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a senior content developer on the Exchange team. Among other things, I write the product documentation for Exchange Server for the areas of virtualization, and high availability, site resilience, disaster recovery, and a few other areas as well. And I'm really excited to be back at another Tech Days Netherlands here talking about Exchange once again. And here we are in the Exchange virtualization best practices session, one of my favorite sessions to deliver. Hopefully you have a lot of questions because this session does intentionally leave time at the end for questions. So hopefully you've got some good questions waiting for you. The agenda is fairly straightforward. I'm going to walk you through our supportability stance for virtualizing Exchange, what you can and cannot do. Then we'll talk about a couple related areas, namely NFS and infrastructure as a service. And then we'll get into our sizing and deployment guidance. And this is guidance that is very up to date and directly from the virtualization PM in Exchange. So let's talk about supportability, but first let's find out who's in the room. So how many of you are already virtualizing Exchange today? All right, it's almost everyone. How many of you are doing that on Hyper-V? Okay, about half of that group. And how many of you are on VMware? All right, almost a little bit more. And how many of you are using something other than Hyper-V or VMware? A couple of you, what are you using?
SendServer,
great. What are you using?
Crystal.
Ah, great. Fantastic. Anybody deployed Exchange for development or lab or test purposes in an IaaS environment like Azure or AWS? Anybody do that yet? A couple of you? Anybody tried that in production? No, you have. You've done that in production. We'll have a little chat after this session. All right. So I think most of you, whether or not you raised your hand as part of any of that, I think most of you are already at the point where you've already made the decision as to whether or not you're going to virtualize Exchange. Some of you may have additional decisions around that to be made. So our guidance, and when I say ours, I mean the Exchange team's guidance. Obviously, you might get different guidance if you were talking to someone from the Hyper-V team versus someone from the Exchange team, but by and large, we are in sync. But from an Exchange perspective, the question that when customers ask us, should I virtualize Exchange, there's really no one answer for every single customer out there. We do support virtualization because we know that for some of our customers it absolutely makes sense. So obviously we're committed to it and we want to make sure that people are successful with Exchange, whether they're using our virtualization platform or some other supported platform. So what we typically say is when you're thinking about an Exchange infrastructure, and this is generally true across the board, not just around platform choices like virtualization. But when you're thinking about an Exchange infrastructure, simpler is always better. Now, for some customers, the physical deployment is going to be the simpler solution. But not for every customer. For some customers, the virtualized deployment will be the simpler solution. So we tell you to simply pick the simplest solution for your organization. But when you do that, when you make that choice, we also want you to have a clear goal as to what exactly you're getting out of by virtue of virtualizing Exchange versus a physical deployment. If you really don't have those clear goals, then we would caution you against doing that simply because virtualization adds overhead, it adds management layers, it adds operational layers, and it adds unnecessary complexity into the system that Exchange doesn't need or really leverage in any deep respects. So if you are going down the road of virtualizing Exchange, you want to make sure that you're actually getting something out of it from a business requirement standpoint. All right, so let's talk about what we support and what we don't support. So in terms of what versions of hypervisors you can use, we support all versions of Hyper-V. And in fact, if you've been keeping track of our support stance, you'll notice this language recently subtly changed. We used to list out all the different editions of Hyper-V that we supported. So we would list like Windows 2008 with Hyper-V, or Hyper-V Server 2008, or Windows 2012 Hyper-V, and Hyper-V Server 2012, and R2, and so forth. And finally, we just got to the point where we support all Hyper-V implementations. So any version of Hyper-V that is supported today can be used to virtualize Exchange. If you're not using Hyper-V, then in order to be supported, you have to use a hypervisor that is listed in our Server Virtualization Validation Program, SVVP. This is a program for third-party hypervisors like VMware and Citrix and the others, and they come in and they do two things. First, they bring their hypervisor in, and they come into our Enterprise Engineering Center, and they prove to us that their hypervisor presents the Windows operating system as we would expect it to be presented on physical hardware, just like Hyper-V does. The second thing they have to do after they go through those tests and they pass those tests, they also have to sign a joint support agreement with Microsoft. And that agreement is a requirement for them to be listed in SVVP as well. That joint support agreement is there specifically for your benefit. In the absence of a joint support agreement, you can call us for help, but we might not be able to do anything because a third-party hypervisor is basically a black box to us. We have no visibility into the code or what it's doing. So we really can't help you too much unless you're able to reproduce the problem outside of that environment. But with a joint support agreement, if you call us or if you call your hypervisor vendor, then we can all work together because we've got this agreement that says, yeah, I can pull you in on customer cases related to your product. And that's why you want to stick with hypervisors that are either Hyper-V or listed on SVVP. Now, in terms of the Exchange roles that you can virtualize, all of the roles are supported. So that's both CAS and Mailbox internally, and also now the recently reintroduced Edge Transport Server that we delivered in SP1. All of those roles can be virtualized. In terms of storage, our storage stance and our storage support around both physical and virtualized deployments largely remains unchanged. It's pretty much the same as what we had in Exchange 2010, with one exception that I'll talk about in a bit. Host-based failover clustering. How many of you have taken your virtualized environments and clustered them at the host level? Anybody? Few of you. Okay. So host-based failover clustering is supported and also supported for all the roles that we have. There are some caveats and issues around that we'll talk about a little bit later on, but that is a supported configuration. In terms of VM migration, we support any migration technologies that move running machines. So as an example, live migration in Hyper-V. That is the key, though. The machine has to remain running while the move is going on. That is key. So the other form of migration that Hyper-V has, quick migration, as an example, is not supported because it freezes a VM before it moves it. We have to have the VM running as it's being migrated. And then JetStress, our storage validation tool, that is supported in virtualized environments, but only in Hyper-V and ESX 4.1 and later. But if you're in either of those environments, this now, of course, means that you can use JetStress within your mailbox guest VMs and validate the storage system that's being used by those VMs as well. You can go to this URL right here, and it will take you right to the single page that has all of our supportability requirements as well. Now, in terms of things that we don't support, some of these we're going to go into more detail later on, but I'll quickly run through them. Things like dynamic memory, so that would be the Hyper-V feature name. VMware calls it memory ballooning. Other hypervisors have different names for it. Anything that dynamically can take memory away from a running VM is something that would not be supported for Exchange. Hypervisor snapshots, fantastic for lab deployments, but not supported in production environments because they literally involve traveling backwards in time. And I'll explain why we can't do that in Exchange in a little bit. Also, differencing and delta disks. We don't support those for a couple reasons. The primary reason is simply supportability around performance and the ability to extend disks as needed. Generally, you'll see a running theme throughout this presentation and throughout our guidance around Exchange, where we really want you to dedicate statically and fixed resources to your Exchange VMs. So something like a differencing disk or a delta disk, again, fantastic for labs, not so good for production. Quick migration or similar technologies, I mentioned that those are not supported, again, because they freeze a machine while moving it. And when you're migrating a machine, we need to be live and up and running. And Hyper-V replica, that's a great new feature in Hyper-V. that is very similar to what we do in Exchange from a high availability standpoint. It's replicating a VM using log shipping to another hypervisor host. And it is fantastic technology for applications that don't already have their own high availability and DR mechanisms. And of course, Exchange has its own, and some very good ones in the form of database availability groups and mailbox database copies. So there's really no need nothing interesting about Hyper-V replica that warrants us to support it for Exchange. Now, the other two things are things where you have a little leeway in terms of our support guidance. So things like apps on the host machine or on the root machine. It's certainly okay and somewhat expected in an enterprise deployment that you'll have some sort of management apps on your Hyper-V host, antivirus software, backup software, monitoring software, that kind of stuff. But what we don't want you to do is install Exchange on your host machine or install SQL on the host or Oracle or SAP or any server-based application like that. I think this is still hear me? Yeah, okay. The whole purpose of your hypervisor root machine is so that it can be remain dedicated to servicing the guest VMs. Okay, so you don't want to do anything on the host machine that could impair its ability to do that. So we don't support any big scaled application. It's management apps only on the root. And the last thing is around processor oversubscription. Now I've talked a little bit, and I'll talk a lot more throughout this session about giving Exchange the resources that it needs. And this is true here, but there are some cases where having just a little bit processor oversubscription can be helpful. So when we talk about processor oversubscription, we're talking about the ratio between the actual physical processors that are in the system and the virtual processors that you assign to your guest VMs. We have a support boundary of a ratio no greater than 2:1. That means two virtual processors for every one physical one you have in the system. We don't want you to overcommit any more than that. And when we talk about that ratio, that does not just mean the Exchange VMs running on that host. That refers to all of the workloads on that host. So you have to calculate the actual number of physical processors and the number of virtual processors you're handing out to all of the VMs on that host and be within that 2:1 ratio. We really want you to be at a 1:1 ratio, but the fact is there are some physical to virtual consolidation scenarios. When you're doing a P2V transition, for example, they will benefit from having somewhat of processor oversubscription. So that's why we supported it in this configuration. But it's nothing that you really want to use for a performant production Exchange system. It's really only designed, as I said, for P2V migrations. All right, NFS and infrastructure as a service. So another quick poll. Anybody deployed Exchange using NFS storage today in a physical or virtual environment? Anyone interested in doing that? Anyone want to do that? One person? Anybody else? How come you want to do it? Not to put you on the spot, but you are the only one who raised your hand. So a customer, if you couldn't hear that, the reason is that the customer is already using NFS for their other VMs, and they're trying to standardize on that as their storage platform. Okay. Has anybody run with Exchange with NFS in the past and had any problems with it? Has anybody run Exchange with NFS in the past and not had any problems with it? Does anybody know what NFS is? Yeah, okay, that's what I thought. Okay, so NFS is a network file system, and it's one that's not supported by Exchange, and it has never been supported by Exchange, but some customers do deploy it, like the customer you mentioned, because they've deployed it in other places, and they want to standardize on the storage stack. Typically, we don't even really talk about NFS too much in any of our sessions because it's not supported, but lately what we've seen in some of the forums and in the communities and on our blog comments, some customers making a big deal out of the fact that we don't support NFS for Exchange. So we thought it would be interesting to talk about just a little bit about why that is and hopefully have everybody finally understand what the deal is with Exchange and NFS and why we don't support it and why we don't have plans to support it. So historically, we have had plenty of customers who have tried to deploy Exchange on NFS. Now, NFS, keep in mind, is not a standard. So every implementation of NFS is proprietary in nature, and they all do different things, and each thing is unique to that NFS implementation. And so the expectation that we get from running on a particular storage stack is that we're going to get the same experience no matter what vendor created that stack, assuming they're following standards. But because NFS is not a standard, they're basically free to do whatever they want, and we have no control over that. Now, historically, we've had two problems with NFS. One has been performance related, and the other has been reliability. Now, in today's world, though, given the advancements that we have in storage technology, and when coupled with all of the work that we've done in Exchange over the past several releases to reduce our IOPS, performance is not really that much of a concern for us anymore. But reliability is, and reliability is actually still a huge concern for us, particularly given the nature of the data that we deal with, mailbox data, which, as you know, is very critical for most customers. So we never supported it for a physical deployment, and then back around the 2007 days when we started getting a bit more hardcore about virtualization support, we carried that support stance forward and said, no, we're not supporting it in virtualized environments either. And typically that wasn't too big of a deal. So why don't we want to use NFS? What are the reliability problems? So it really comes down to three primary areas. And again, this is some deep, long-standing experience we have with directly working with customers on these platforms. So there's three concerns that we have with NFS implementations. The first one is that that forced unit access, or what's called write-through capabilities. So this is where an application like Exchange needs to actually commit some data to the disk. Okay, there may be layers of caching in between the storage controller and the actual disk itself, but this is a request from an application to write something directly on disk. What we find historically is when we send that request into an NFS stack, the NFS stack, more often than not, does not come back with the right answer. It says, oh yeah, sure, I'll commit that to disk right away. And then it lingers in some L1 or L2 cache and may or may not actually ever get written to disk. So that's one challenge right there. Another challenge is write ordering. And write ordering is particularly important for an application like Exchange, whose database technology is predicated on the orderly playback of transaction logs that have ordered records in them. Obviously, ordered writes are super important for us because if writes become out of order, then your database becomes logically corrupt and no good anymore. So write ordering is super critical for us, but the NFS implementations cannot guarantee write ordering. So they could be writing bits out of order and logically corrupt your database. And in fact, we've seen that happen over and over with customers who've called in for support on this platform. We had a customer call in that every single database that they had on their storage was logically corrupt all of a sudden. So the first thing that support does is they get them up and running on dial tone databases. So those are those empty databases that allow the users just to start sending and receiving email, even though they don't have access to their old data yet. Literally a day after creating the dial tone databases and getting the users set up again, those dial tone databases became corrupt. And that's kept happening again and again and again. So finally, the customer said, you know what, I was wrong early on. We haven't implemented iSCSI just yet. We're still on NFS. Bingo. Okay, so the third issue, torn I/O protection. That's another area where that's a grave concern for us. So torn I/O is when an application like Exchange issues a single I/O, and then within the storage stack, that I/O gets chopped into multiple I/Os. And then, in that case, some of them get committed to disk, some don't, and we end up once again missing data. So that is our primary concern around NFS. And because there's no standards and no guarantees of integrity or no way to implement a forcing of those features that we need in Exchange to keep things consistent, there's really no way that we can support NFS. But here's why it plays into virtualization. Because when you think about NFS, again, that's just Exchange. NFS is just a network file system, so it's, it can be physical systems connected via Ethernet to some storage stack right there. And here again, this is not a good deal. This is not supported. So if a customer were going to do this, we would say thumbs down. We don't want you to do this. It's not supported, and you're definitely going to have a bad experience with this. Once virtualization, though, became more and more common, some customers started to think about this, and then they realized they could use the abstraction provided by virtualization to abstract non-block level storage away from the application directly and only bubble that up to the hypervisor, thereby making the hypervisor responsible for masking the storage issues. So that looks something like this. I take my physical servers, and then I virtualize them, and once they've been virtualized, then I've got a nice hypervisor storage stack, and that is backed by NFS, but from the hypervisor standpoint, it looks like a VHD, so Exchange isn't going to complain, and you know Exchange supports VHDs, so it must be good to go, right? No, not so good. The hypervisor is now responsible for all the storage semantics, and they may or may not be able to handle that. They may, in fact, result in a masking of severe storage problems that you don't realize until you do something like initiate a database switchover or try to fail over a database or maybe even mount a database on one of the servers in this environment. So, don't do these things either. We have no plans to change our support around NFS. There's no real reason to do so for us. There's no business justification around that, which is what drives all of our changes in any of our code. It's not a good idea for customers because of the reliability aspects I mentioned. And quite frankly, there are much better choices out there for storage where we don't really need to entertain another type of storage. You could do iSCSI. You could do Fibre Channel. You could also do SMB 3.0 right now. That's a new feature, a new storage feature that we support with Exchange 2013. And that can be Windows Server 2012 SMB 3.0 or any other SMB 3.0 implementation. Because unlike NFS, SMB is a standard, and all the implementations have to adhere to that standard. So SMB 3.0 is actually not a bad solution. Now, admittedly, our support for SMB 3.0 is somewhat limited. And by that, I mean we don't support direct access from Exchange to an SMB 3.0 file share. What we do support is hosting a VHD, or if you're using VMware, a VMDK, some sort of virtual hard disk on one of these SMB 3.0 file shares. So that's the support that we have. But again, that works great, and because it's SMB 3.0, it has the added advantage of giving you some extra resilience for files going away and network glitches, network oscillation, if you will. All right. So infrastructure as a service. I think there was a couple hands that went up that said that they'd done this. I think maybe even one hand went up that said they'd done this in production environments. So deploying Exchange in this environment, which is also a virtualized environment, so like Azure, Amazon Web Service, et cetera, those are possible to do today. They are fine for dev, fine for labs, fine for test, fine for demos. No good for production, and in fact not supported for production, including Azure. And there's a couple reasons for that. None of these infrastructure providers, including Azure, have really the basic prerequisites that you would need to deploy what we would consider the proper architecture for Exchange. So as an example, Exchange is all about low-cost, direct-attached, JBOD, non-rated cheap, slow, large storage. Okay, you don't get that in Azure or AWS. What you get is expensive shared storage where you don't control the IOPS and you don't get to say, you know, how much IOPS is going to back that environment. So you can't really size the environment appropriately in one of these provider spaces. The other thing is, often when you reboot these individual servers, they will change IP addresses, and that will do things like break mail flow in some scenarios and so forth. And then finally, when you think about it, and in fact, when you compare the direct cost of goods between a cloud provider like Office 365, which is Exchange hosted in the cloud, of course, versus rolling your own and hosting Exchange in your own Azure tenant, the Azure tenant ends up being significantly more expensive than what the cost would be if you'd gone with Office 365. So there may be some reasons you don't want to go with Office 365 and that you prefer control over your own, but really Azure and IaaS are not the place to do that. So that would mean largely your choices would be Office 365 or some other Exchange Online hoster or deploying it yourself on premises. All right, let's talk about sizing and deployment now. Sizing and planning for virtualization, the good news around this is it's very similar to the same exercises you would do for deploying a physical environment. And in fact, that is generally the approach we would want you to take. Start as if you're deploying a physical environment and then add any necessary overhead for the virtualization environment. So let's talk about the first rule of thumb around sizing, and that's that oversubscription again. Oversubscription is generally a bad thing. Again, the one area where we do support it is the processor oversubscription, but really that support is designed for those P to V conversions of machines, when you're taking a running physical machine and converting it into a running virtual machine. That is why we have that support boundary. If you're not doing that, you really should ignore that and assign a one-to-one mapping between your physical and logical processors for all of your hosts that are running Exchange workloads. If you don't do that, if the Exchange server itself does not have enough CPU power, that will directly negatively affect the user experience. It will slow down mail delivery. The queues will start to grow. It will degrade the content index experience. So your ActiveSync users and your Outlook web app users and those users searching archive mailboxes or Exchange online, they will not have a good search experience because the catalog will be out of date. And the store will slow down. The round-trip operations that the store is doing using RPCs will start to slow down considerably, and you'll introduce a terrible amount of latency into the system. And when that happens, the user experience just goes down the drain very fast. Don't oversubscribe. Now, in terms of processor sizing, this is one of the few places where you do have to account for hyperconverged overhead. So there will be some additional overhead that you add in here. It depends on the hypervisor that you're using. In the case of Hyper-V, we want you to add 10% additional CPU overhead into the hypervisor host. If you're using VMware, last I checked, their adjustment factor was somewhere around 4 or 5%. But you'll want to check with them based on the exact version of their hypervisor that you're using. They will be the ones to give you that value. Why do you need that value? Because just like a physical deployment, we want you to size a virtualized deployment using the tools that we give you. And that includes our primary tool, the server role requirements calculator. And in fact, in that calculator, you'll see two things. One is a drop-down for server role virtualization. That's just a yes or no. You say yes to that when you're in a virtualized environment. And then there's hypervisor CPU adjustment factor. And this is where you add in the processor overhead for your hypervisor. Again, as you can see, it's about 10% for Hyper-V. But ask your hypervisor vendor, if you're not using Hyper-V, what their value should be. I guarantee you they will know exactly what you're talking about because every one of these vendors has worked very closely, not just with the Windows team for the certification, but we also work very closely with them in Exchange as well. Okay, hyperthreading. How many of you are using hyperthreading on your servers today? All right, a couple of you. And so hyperthreading is pretty cool technology. It's not new. It's actually somewhat old technology. But it's Intel proprietary technology that does two things. So from a Windows perspective, it doubles the number of processors that you have. So it makes it look like you've got twice the number of cores. So as an example, I've got four CPUs right up here, these ones at the top. And each one of those CPUs has four cores on them. And that would be these sets of four cores. So I've got a total of 16 cores, 16 physical cores in this system. When I turn on hyperthreading, as if by magic, 16 more cores appear. But those are logical cores. They're not real, obviously. The system didn't magically create 16 more physical cores in the system. That would be cool technology, but hyper-threading is not quite that cool. But it does create those logical processors. So if you do something like pull up Task Manager, you'll see 32 CPUs listed there. That's kind of cool. But the reality is there's only really 16 there. And at any given time, hyperthreading is only going to give you anywhere from a 5%, maybe on upwards of a 20% boost in processor power. So that's a big plus there. But there's no guarantee of what that number is going to be at any given time, let alone whether you're going to get any boost at any given time. So hyperthreading is great to turn on. Go ahead and turn it on your hypervisor host machines. Your Exchange VMs will benefit from it. But when you're doing your sizing exercise, and in particular, when you're figuring out that physical to virtual processor ratio that we talked about, you want to only count the actual physical ones. So you're only going to count 16 cores. You're not going to put in that you've got 32 cores in the system because you're using Hyper-V. You're going to say, in our calculator tool, you've got 16 cores. All right, so obviously the processor is the most, probably the most complicated aspect of it. The rest is pretty simple. In terms of memory, all you have to do is really statically assign the amount of memory that Exchange needs, and the calculator will tell you how much memory that is based on the inputs that you put in there. In terms of the other memory aspects, the only other place where memory might come into play is if the hardware you're running happens to support a memory technology called NUMA. That stands for Non-Uniform Memory Access, and it's a hardware-based technology that allows dynamic path widths in between the memory segments and the CPUs. And so that gives some applications that are NUMA aware, they can take advantage of those optimizations at the hardware layer, and that gives them faster access into memory. So it speeds things up for those applications. Now, Exchange is not a NUMA aware application, so it has no idea whether or not it's running on NUMA hardware. But if you are running on NUMA hardware, Windows is NUMA aware, and your hypervisor is probably NUMA aware, which means your hypervisors will likely take advantage of those optimizations, and even though Exchange is not NUMA aware, an Exchange VM running on such a hypervisor would be able to take advantage of the optimizations. They'll, of course, happen transparently to Exchange, but Exchange will still benefit from them. So if you do have NUMA, go ahead and enable it. You may see a slight performance improvement for both Exchange and non-Exchange workloads. For storage, storage should be block-level storage, and as always, it should be optimized for IOPS and low latency. Okay. Now, today, when we talk about optimizing for IOPS, that's not as difficult as it was in 2010 or 2007, and certainly not as difficult as it was in 2003. And in fact, just going from 2003 all the way to 2013, we've had a reduction in IOPS that Exchange needs by about 94 or 95%. So we don't need heavy IOPS anymore, but we still do need some capacity, and we do need something with low latency. So typically, our recommendation around storage in a virtualized environment would be the same recommendation we have in a physical environment, which is use JBOD, just a bunch of disks, so no RAID, and you're using 7,500 RPM SAS disks. You could get away with using SATA disks, but SAS disks have a slightly less annual failure rate and a more reliable duty cycle associated with them. So those are the ones that would be part of our preferred architecture. We also want you to take advantage of any optimizations that your hypervisors may have at the network layer. Now, we have done some work in 2013 to simplify the networking requirements, particularly around database availability group members. And in fact, you may have even noticed recently this week on TechNet, we actually updated our guidance to state that we no longer recommend two separate NICs. We now just recommend a single NIC for all of your DAG members. So that simplifies things, and that single NIC configuration now also enables you to potentially take advantage of additional networking optimizations that your hypervisor may or may not have. Again, it's going to vary depending on the hypervisor you're using. All right. Now, most customers, when they buy the hypervisor host, they're not going to dedicate it just to Exchange VMs. So they make Exchange VMs with the Exchange VMs. So that might be Active Directory, servers, maybe other database servers, et cetera, et cetera. And that don't have any support restrictions around co-locating with non-Exchange VMs, but we do strongly recommend that the resource allocation that you use for those non-Exchange VMs does not in any way impair or take resources away from your Exchange VMs. One caveat there. So go ahead and co-locate them, but definitely do not allow them to steal resources or choke the Exchange workload out. I'll just hit it a bunch of times because that's the American way to fix things. Hold it higher? wait, this is being filmed, and I don't... All right. Users per host. This is another area where, yes, you have the ability to do certain things, but you don't want to do them just because you can. So obviously with today's VMs, they've got a lot of processing power. And a single hypervisor host is capable of supporting hundreds of VMs. It could maybe possibly even support all of the mailbox servers in your organization and therefore all of the users in your organization. We don't like that in Exchange. We're much more into scale out than scale up. Scale up scenarios, while supported, are typically discouraged because, for one thing, you're putting way too many eggs in one basket, if you understand that metaphor. We don't want a significant majority of your user population to be impacted by any single outage. So there's no reason to scale up and just pack everything that you can into the system. There's also the concept of failure domains that should preclude you from doing that. We'll talk about that in a bit. But generally, we don't want you to just try to cram every user that you can onto the system. Now, if you are a very small organization and you've got maybe just a few hundred or a couple thousand users, then a very small environment with all of your users might end up being a good solution for you. But in doing so, you may be sacrificing some availability and fault tolerance, again, which we'll talk about in a minute. So these extreme scale-up scenarios, we typically want you to avoid and use the excess capacity for non-Exchange workloads. Don't just cram all of Exchange onto there. All right, failure domains. And this is a concept that applies not just to a virtualized environment, but it also applies to a physical environment as well. So failure domains, if you're not familiar with them, failure domains are simply areas of shared something where if that something fails, it takes out multiple things. And you see failure domains all over the place. They are all over your data centers. If you walk around them, you'll see them all over the place. Multiple things plugged into the same power supply. That power supply is a failure domain for those things. Multiple servers in the same rack. The rack or the top of rack is a failure domain because all of those servers are in there. Multiple VMs on a hypervisor host are all in the same failure domain, that hypervisor host. Because if that host fails, it's taking out all of those VMs with them. Now, failure domains, they're a little easier to avoid in the physical realm than they are in the virtual realm. Because again, in the virtual realm, that's completely based on putting multiple things on the same physical thing. Whereas in the physical world, everything is separate and isolated from one another. So in the virtual world, when you're architecting around failure domains, you want to make sure that, in particular, your mailbox databases and copies of those databases are never placed within the same failure domain. So as an example, when you're deploying a database availability group in a virtualized environment, you would probably want each one of those DAG members to be a VM on a separate hypervisor host. Because if you don't do that, when that host fails, it's going to take out more than one of your DAG members at the same time. And it's possible, if you have not configured things, that each one of those DAG members being taken out had copies of the same database on it. So you're losing multiple copies at the same time as well. We wouldn't want you to ever be in that situation. So you're going to want to architect around your failure domains. That is particularly important the smaller you get. So think about it like this. What is the smallest DAG that you can create? Just shout it out if you know the answer. No, shout it out. Don't mumble it. Shout it out. No one ever shouts. Shout it out. What's the smallest DAG? Two. That's right. Two members. So you've got a two-member DAG, and you've got, of course, what do you need with a two-member DAG? No, not a backup. A witness, that's right. So I've got two DAG members and one witness. How many physical servers is that?
Three,
that's right. If I were deploying that in the same that same configuration, two DAG member, one witness server in a virtualized environment, and I had to architect properly around failure domains, how many physical servers would I need? Three, that's exactly right. Bingo. So you can start to see that as failure domains start coming into play in some configurations, you don't get any benefit from going to a virtualized environment. And in fact, going to a virtualized environment, unless you duplicate the fault tolerance you would have in the physical world, you're going to end up lowering your availability and compromising your Exchange solution. So that's just one example. Another example would be the dependencies as well. So that includes the same principle for your directory servers as well. You wouldn't put all of your virtualized AD servers on the same host, and you wouldn't want your witness server on the same host as any of the DAG members that are members of the DAG for which it's a witness. You want to isolate those things from one another. All right, so host-based failover clustering. I mentioned this earlier that this is supported, but when we talk about host-based failover clustering, we're really talking about very rudimentary hypervisor-level high availability and disaster recovery. We're not talking about exchange-aware protection, exchange-aware high availability, exchange-aware disaster recovery. Exchange has no idea that the host it's running on is in a hypervisor cluster, in part because it has no idea it's running in a virtualized environment to begin with. So Exchange knows nothing about this. So anything that you're doing with host-based failover clustering is not giving you any benefits for Exchange whatsoever. It may give you a maintenance benefit of being able to move VMs off a server so that you can do maintenance on a host, but Exchange already has that native technology built into the DAG. Okay, so our strong recommendation is if you are going to deploy host-based failover clustering and you've got Exchange mailbox servers in that cluster, you want to deploy a DAG with those mailbox servers. You may think of it as belt and suspenders, which may be seem like it's overkill, but remember, it'll be the DAG that's actually providing you with the Exchange HA and the Exchange DR. The hypervisor stuff is not going to do you really that much good. One other thing, when you are in a host-based failover cluster, you have the ability to do these VM migrations. And again, I mentioned earlier that we support live migration and not quick migration. So in the live migration scenarios, we're moving a running machine. And in the case of a running machine, we might be moving a running mailbox server that is a member of a DAG, and it could be a very heavily used mailbox server. And because the machine is running while it's used, running while it's being moved, that means that the machine, while under load, is going to slow down that move as well. And in fact, while that machine is under load, it can, and we've seen it actually happen in some cases, where it stops responding to cluster heartbeats. Now, when I talk about the cluster heartbeats, I don't mean the DAG's cluster. I mean the hypervisor cluster heartbeats. So the VM itself stops responding. And when that happens, that VM gets evicted from the hypervisor cluster. And then the admin has to go in and reintegrate it and so forth. We call that a brownout when that happens. The thing isn't offline, but it's just so busy and it's in the process of being moved, it cannot respond to these heartbeats. Now, what you can do, you can actually play with heartbeat intervals and heartbeat loss tolerance at the cluster level. And so you can minimize these brownout periods by adjusting these values up. So as an example, you would be manipulating the same subnet threshold and the same subnet delay. So the threshold is the number of heartbeats, and the delay is how long we'll wait for a response. Now, if you're in a multi-subnet environment, those values will actually be cross-subnet threshold and cross-subnet delay. If you're in the same single-subnet environment, then they'll be same subnet. But be aware, though, that when you're adjusting those values, they could also be masking some underlying network problems as well. So you want to make sure that everything is really good to go with your network and that it is just actually a very busy server that's browning out in this scenario and not something else that may be causing the loss of heartbeats. The other thing is, after you have finished the move, you'll want to set the values back to their default settings, which is what you see right here. Adjusting these values too upwardly high can mask network problems and can actually lower resiliency for a Windows failover cluster. All right, dynamic memory. dynamic memory or VMware's ballooning or memory reclamation or memory magic or memory madness or crazy memory or insert funny joke about memory here. All of those things, they are fantastic for lab environments. They are terrible for production environments. And not just terrible, they're not supported for production environments as well. Dynamic memory is simply not good for an application like Exchange that does not deal well with memory disappearing out from under it. Let me illustrate that for you. And it's going to be very easy to understand why that is. And we only need to look at two performance counters to understand that. So the first counter we're going to look at is this one in orange. It's RPC average latency. One of the interesting things about Exchange is that an application like Exchange, given all the services and components that it has, it literally publishes well over 1,000 performance objects and counters. But of all the information that Exchange is publishing, this one counter, that RPC average latency, more so than any other counter, just by knowing its value, will give you an excellent idea as to what the user experience is currently like for your Exchange users. So obviously we're talking about RPCs and we're talking about latency. So with RPC traffic, lower latency is better. The lower the latency, the better the client experience. The higher the latency, the slower things are and the worse the client experience is. Now, typically what we like to see is latency definitely less than 20 milliseconds, but even here, you know, less than 10 milliseconds or just barely over 10 milliseconds, that's great. That's perfect. But when we start to see it go up to where it's almost 50 milliseconds or it's sustaining itself above 20 or 30 in some cases, that's not good. That's the user experience going down the tubes very fast. So can anybody guess what might have happened here to change that pattern of RPC average latency? I'll give you a hint. It's the title of this slide. That's right. Dynamic memory came in and took the memory away. And we can see that by looking at the other counter, available bytes. You can see we were doing pretty good. We had some memory there. And then, boom, all of a sudden, memory, all of it was taken away. And as soon as that happened, RPC average latency just started going nuts. The user experience just became terrible at that point. So we know for a fact, we've observed this many, many times, dynamic memory is terrible for production Exchange servers, so don't do it. Now, hypervisor snapshots. This is another hypervisor feature that is fantastic for lab environments, but no good for production environments. Now, I use this in my lab all the time. I would not be as productive as I am without hypervisor snapshots. As you might imagine, for someone who writes documentation on Exchange, I'm writing the documentation based on pre-release builds so that when we release the software to you, the documentation matches everything and we can ship it all at once. So when I'm doing the pre-release builds, we have daily builds. So every single day I could get a new build and look at fixes and things like that. And so obviously to do that, I want to have a good stable environment in each case. So I wouldn't want to take a daily build pre-release software and install it over the previous day's daily build or over the previous day's daily build and so forth and just keep upgrading. That would not be a viable scenario because that's not a scenario any of our customers would ever do. So there's no point in me replicating that. But what our customers will do is they'll take the bits and they'll install them in a fresh environment or in an upgrade environment. And so I can duplicate that. So what I do after I'm done with whatever I needed to do, I will then revert back to snapshots of my machines that I'd taken previously in time. Now, that's easy for me to do. In my lab, I've got six VMs, five of them are Exchange servers, and one of them is a directory server. So when I'm taking snapshots, I'm taking a snapshot at the same point in time of all six VMs before I even install Exchange. So I've got a brand new, clean, empty Active Directory and five servers that have all the prereqs for Exchange installed, but there's no Exchange in the environment. It's clean, pure, fresh Windows org. Then I snapshot that and periodically update it with Windows Update. So I snapshot that. Then I install Exchange, do whatever I need to do, and then I roll everything back to that previous snapshot, and everything goes back to before Exchange was installed. And it's great, but the reason it works is because the entire topology rolls back together. An individual Exchange server cannot move backwards in time by itself, but if the entire organization goes back in time, well, then everything goes back in time, and no one knows they were from the future, and that works out. But if one person goes back in time by themselves, they know that they're out of time. They're out of sync now. They've traveled backwards in time. People look at them funny. Well, that doesn't happen. But people know that this machine is not going to work anymore. It will be irrevocably broken. Now, if you were to do this in a production environment, take snapshots and want to roll back, you would have to roll back your entire exchange organization. So by entire exchange organization, I mean every single exchange server in your organization. Oh, and I also mean every single directory server in your organization as well, because Exchange is directory enabled, and all the directory stuff has to go back as well. You're not going to do that in your production environments. You're going to do that in your labs. It's great to do in the labs, but you're not going to do that in production. So it's not supported. No time travel yet for Exchange going backwards. Like humans, we have to move forward in time. All right, and then there's also workload management to consider. So given all the other things that are going on with Exchange that are resource related, on top of all that, there's also this feature called workload management. So in Exchange 2010, we introduced this feature called user throttling, or what we sometimes call client throttling. And this was where the system had the ability to look at what the user was doing, and if the user was consuming more resources than we thought an individual user should be consuming at a given time, then the throttling process would slow down that user's activity and basically throttle them back until they were back into acceptable resource range, resource utilization range. In 2013, we take that one step further. So we still have the user throttling, but now we also have system throttling and time-based assistance that run under workload management. So workload management is not just looking at the user resource consumption now, but it's also looking at system resource consumption as well. And when you think about resource utilization on an Exchange server or maybe even other workloads, it's typically something like this. You know, you've got peaks and you've got valleys. What workload management is trying to do is shave off those peaks and fill in those valleys to sort of give you a more balanced and even use of the resources on the system. But the way workload management makes its decisions, it looks at what is currently going on the system, but it also looks at what resources are available and allocated to the system as well. So if you're using something like oversubscription or dynamic memory or anything else that can dynamically change the resource allocation, then the decisions that workload management are going to make are going to be bad. And you don't want it to make bad decisions, because a bad decision could be, I need to get a bunch of system work done, and there's plenty of memory on the box, so I'm just going to start jamming these assistants through and get all this work done. And then in the middle of those work, all the memory goes away, but all that stuff is scheduled and in process. Now everything is grinding to a halt, and workload management, where it was trying to help you manage resources, is now just getting crushed as a result of resources disappearing out from under it. All right, so virtualization of Exchange 2013 is supported. It's important to understand what hypervisor features are supported and which ones aren't. And of the ones that are supported, it's also important to understand which ones make sense for Exchange and which ones don't. You also want to make sure that you don't oversubscribe. I can't remember if I mentioned that in this session or not, but definitely don't oversubscribe. And that includes memory, CPU, storage, any resource that Exchange needs. And of course, as I said, not all of the hypervisor features are going to make sense for production Exchange servers. Some you'll only be able to enjoy in your labs or your demo and test environments, but there are plenty that you'll be able to enjoy in production environments as well. All right. So with that, we've got, looks like, a fair amount of time for questions, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. And as a bonus, it doesn't need to be related to virtualization. I will take any Exchange questions that you have. How about that? And now still no hands go up. Okay. I'll take any VMware questions you have. No. Storage questions. Any other questions? Now's the time. Yes, sir. Yes, very good question. Thank you. So the question was, I hear that you've reintroduced the Edge Transport Server with Service Pack 1, but I haven't been able to find any information about what it does, how you manage it, why it's there, et cetera, et cetera. Would you say that's a fair assessment? Okay, so So yes, we did reintroduce it. At RTM, we only shipped the CAS and mailbox roles. In SP1, we reintroduced Edge. The sole purpose that we reintroduced Edge is to give customers with Exchange Online a secure Exchange server that could be deployed in their perimeter network. Okay, and so that gives us that finishes the scenario of secure end-to-end email between Exchange Online and on-premises Exchange while allowing an Exchange server to be in a perimeter network. So that's what the Edge Transport Server is, just like in 2010 and 2007. It is designed to be a perimeter network SMTP gateway that handles all incoming and outgoing mail for the system. But it is a little different from what we had in 2010 and 2007. So as an example, there is no graphical user interface to manage Edge. All of the management of Edge is done using PowerShell. There are 33 commandlets that you use to manage Edge, but all of them you're probably familiar with if you've done any management of hub transport in 2010 and 2007. On Edge, we do anti-spam only. We're not doing antivirus. Antivirus would happen either prior to Edge in a cloud-based service like Exchange Online Protection or into the mailbox role, which is where Hub lives. Is that bad? Yes. Don't what? Don't hold it from here? I don't know what I'm doing with this. What are the rules? So one of the reasons there is no GUI is the GUI in Exchange 2013 is the Exchange Admin Center. EAC, even though we're still using the ECP virtual directory, it's still the Exchange Admin Center. Obviously, that runs under IIS. And so we made a trade-off. We intentionally decided not to have a GUI for managing Edge. Because it was an SMTP perimeter network server, we wanted to have as small of an attack surface as possible. And so having IIS on there just so you could have a GUI, we thought was not worth the trade-off there. So no IIS means a significantly reduced attack surface for that server. And it does mean PowerShell-only management, but again, the 33 commandlets, they're all related to anti-spam, IP address lists, IP block lists, allow lists, sender reputation, all that stuff. It's very easy to set up. You only need 4 gigabytes of memory to run Edge. It'll take, even if you've never set up Edge, it'll only take you about 15 minutes start to finish, and that includes configuring the Edge subscription so you can get the secure connectors in there. And then the way it works in terms of communication, that depends on whether or not you have CAS and mailbox co-located inside the organization. If they are not co-located, then Edge will send email to the front-end transport service running on the client access server, whereas if they are co-located, then Edge will communicate directly with the transport service running on the mailbox server. I think that's everything you asked. Yes. You're welcome. Great question. Yes. Okay. So the question was, is there a reason why installing roll-ups in a virtualized environment seems to take longer than what you've experienced in a physical environment?
No, just virtual. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
It's for a small company with all the Exchange roll-ups.
Okay. So a couple things about that is the first thing I would say is in 2013, we don't have roll-up updates anymore. In the new servicing model that we have, we now have cumulative updates and service packs, and there's no difference between the two except in name only. So we've released 4 updates, cumulative update 1, 2, 3, and then cumulative update 4 is actually service pack 1. And the reason we do that is simply for the Microsoft standard product lifecycle reporting. That's what customers base their purchasing decisions on, and that's how they buy software based on service pack lifecycle milestones. So that is why 1 cumulative update somewhere in our release cycle ends up being called a service pack instead of a CU. But otherwise, they're exactly the same thing. It's the full product. So if you were deploying something fresh, you just download whatever the latest is, and you deploy that new, and boom, you're on the latest code. But it's also designed like service packs are, where it can be deployed on top of something and do a build-to-build upgrade of that something. In terms of what took so long, that is really difficult to say without doing a whole lot of postmortem. I will say that that experience is not normal at all. I've been using very resource-constrained Hyper-V servers over multiple product releases of Exchange. In fact, I'm using the same servers for my 2013 lab that I was given back in the 2007 days for that lab. So it's super, super weak hardware. But I have not seen slow update or slow installs at all. Obviously, the first install in my environment is the slowest because it's doing all the schema updates, and that's all happening on the same host. But other than that, I've clocked it at around 11 minutes per install for each subsequent machine, and that is a co-located CASN mailbox. The best source of information, if you did want to dig into this further, would be to look at the Exchange setup logs, because we do quite a bit of verbose logging in that log directory. And we don't catch everything, but you'll at least be able to see when functions started and stopped and what those timestamps were. So you'll be able to tell if you're spending too much time in some specific task or subtask. And then if that's the case, if it looks like some specific subtask is taking too long, then I would start thinking linearly about the problem and troubleshoot it that way. So if, as an example, if it was making LDAP calls to your directory server and that was just taking forever, then I would look at things like DC Diag, NL test, and verify connectivity between that server and your domain controllers, those kinds of things. Is it the certification check? Probably not. You would have to be in a disconnected lab, which I don't think you're in, or in a disconnected scenario, for that to happen. And even that, that's just going to time out, and it's not going to block setup or slow things down. It'll slow down for a very short amount of time. I think the CRL timeout is somewhere like 120 seconds. So what is that, 2 minutes, I think, is the longest it would sit there and wait. Yeah. All right. Good question, though. Thank you. All right, who wants to go next? Yes, sir. Great question. And I'm not trying to distract you from an answer by smashing into this, unless that worked, in which case. So the question was, I noticed that the public folder documentation around modern public folders in Exchange 2013 was updated recently to reflect some new reported limits that we have around public folders, such as no more than 10,000 individual public folders in the complete hierarchy in the public folder tree. What are the technical reasons around that, and are there going to be any changes around that? Modern public folders are brand new. With all of the technology that we have in Exchange, particularly brand new technology, we work very hard to get guidance around things like limits or sizing or planning and things like that, so that when customers are deploying these things, they have the experience that we hope that they have with them. And to do that, we have to gather data from in-place production deployments. We don't have a lot of public folder deployments from which we can draw on. We have TAP customers. We've got some stuff going on in Office 365. We have a little bit in dog food, but we don't really use public folders that much within Microsoft. So we don't really have a lot of data on which to say what really would be the actual number. We chose 10,000 because where we're at right now, that does seem to be a reasonable yet conservative upper limit. But we understand that where we are right now is nowhere near where we actually need to be, particularly when we talk to customers who in some cases have more than a million folders in their hierarchy, literally. I was just talking with a customer a couple days ago. They have more than a million folders in their public folder hierarchy, and they have more than a petabyte of public folder data that they're going to have to move. So they won't be moving to modern public folders anytime soon. So I can tell you that the folks on the performance team And the PMs and devs on the public folder team and collaboration team, they are extremely sensitive about this, and they are working very hard to first get that limit increased, and second, get real data out there that we can provide to customers that is actually prescriptive and maybe something that we can encode in the calculator so that they will have a stable and reliable public folder environment. So I think my guidance for now would be is if you do have a large hierarchy larger than 10,000, you're sort of stuck now anyway because of that. So you might as well wait and see how things shake out. For most customers, you're not going to be moving your public folders anyway until all of your user mailboxes have been moved into the new environment. So there's going to be, we feel like there is a little bit more time before the pressure's really on around public folder migrations. Eventually, the pressure's going to be really on, and those numbers are going to have to be where you expect them to be and where we want them to be. But for right now, that is one of the reasons we publish those limits, is to let people know that, yeah, this is where we are right now. Don't try to do anything beyond this, because we don't really know what could happen. We don't have the experience or knowledge yet in that space, so we don't want you to go beyond this limit. So I hope that answers it for you as to where we are. All right, thank you. All right, we still have a couple minutes left. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Sure, great. So the question was, we've got the Exchange Admin Center, which is our web-based GUI for managing Exchange. That is accessible both from your intranet and via your internet if you publish it that way. And I think your question is, what's the reason for that? Is that right?
Yeah.
So what's the reason for that? What's the best way to disable external access? Okay, so there's literally a switch that you can hit, and that will turn off external access if you don't want it. And of course, remember, it's not publishing itself, so whatever reverse proxy you're using or firewall or load balancer or whatever device that is separating the outside from the inside, that device would have to have knowledge and awareness of the ECP virtual directory to send traffic there in the first place. So if it's not published there, then nothing's going to have a path from the outside. But there still is a mechanism where you can turn off external access. So even if it is published, it won't work. We won't authenticate and let you in at that point. Yes, if you are using Outlook web app, that's right. That's right, you will. But that is different. That is end-user self-service access, and that is different from turning off administrative access through that UI. So even with administrative access turned off, an administrator with a mailbox who was using that account, even though it's against best practices, if they were doing that, they would still be able to get into OWA options and do their thing. They would not be able to, on the drop-down, to see the Manage My Organization, though. They would only be able to manage themselves. Now, in terms of needing any extra servers, you don't need any extra servers for management at all. The ECP is built into the client access role. So every single client access server that you have is the web server that functions as the connection endpoint. So you can connect to an individual server, or you could even use the same namespace that you're using for email right now. So as an example, mail.contoso.com/ECP. That will take you to your load balancer, and your load balancer will send you to one of the CAS, and you'll open up ECP against one of those CAS. You don't need any extra servers to manage anything in Exchange. And in fact, you don't even need to install the management tools, because all you really need is a web browser to connect to CAS or remote PowerShell. But if you do install the management tools, you do also get the Exchange snap-ins for PowerShell and the Exchange help file locally as well. Thank you. All right. Probably time for one more. Oh, you guys are like, no, not another one. Please. Last one. Okay.
Yeah. On the PowerShell front, Exchange is using a PowerShell snap-in,
mm-hmm.
not a module.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this? Why is it still
yes.
this way?
Yes. So the question was, with respect to Exchange, we are still using the snap-in model, not a module. We are actually using both, but the way in which we've implemented it, we've got our modules that act as snap-ins. And in fact, if you look at some of the modules, for example, we were just talking about Edge. So if you look at the Edge modules, you'll see that, in fact, they have the old Exchange 2000 name associated with them. We have not changed the approach that we're using because, one is legacy backward compatibility. That is less and less important to us now, but it's more important to customers. So it's not so interesting for us in the service, but customers need that. And I think we just haven't really had any need to do that given all the other things that we wanted to do. There hasn't been any real big push to do that. If you've got specific concerns around that or you want to file a bug or a DCR or something, I'm happy to take that back with me if there's some changes we can make around that. All right. Oh, sure, another hand went up. That's not my fault, not my fault. Yes. Great question. So the question was, Exchange 2013 SP1 introduced a new communication mechanism for Outlook called MAPI over HTTP. And is this something that we would recommend customers go and deploy? Eventually, yes. But just like modern public folders, MAPI over HTTP is brand new. We've only begun to roll it out internally at Microsoft. We've only begun to roll it out even slower in Office 365. So there again, we don't have a lot of real-world production data around that feature. So our guidance right now is try it out in the lab. You can use it in your production environments, but we don't have any details to tell you how to size the environment or what the impact your network is going to be yet, or how much bandwidth you'll need or what the latency would be like or what the client experience is going to be like and so forth. So you may decide to wait a little bit before implementing it. Now, if you do implement it, we actually make it super simple. It's just set organization config, and you take MAPI HTTP enabled, and you set it to true. You wait a couple hours, and boom, it's now being advertised as part of the AutoDiscover client response. And so when your Outlook 2013 SP1 clients get that XML response, that's when they would dynamically change to using MAPI over HTTP when they were previously using RPC over HTTP. So in Exchange 2013, we only allow Outlook to connect via RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere. There's no more RPC over TCP. And so now we've taken that one step further, and we've eliminated the RPC component of the communication. So now it is just the pure MAPI verbs that are wrapped in HTTP packets that are sent between Outlook and Exchange. And then we also do this, we have this HTTP hanging notification that we keep open as well, that keeps the communication open. Now what we see with this is there are definite benefits to using MAPI over HTTP, particularly in the scenarios where you have a laptop or some other device that roams from wireless access point to wireless access point. As it is disconnecting and reconnecting, we find that about 82% of the users in that scenario will reconnect within 5 seconds or less. The other useful scenario is the suspend, resume, or hibernate wake up. In those cases, once again, it's about 80% of the users end up reconnecting within 30 seconds or less. So by removing the RPC component from the transport layer, and by transport, I don't mean SMTP, I mean network transport layer, so I'm talking the OSI model here. By removing RPC communication, just wrapping the MAPI in HTTP, we get a much faster and better client experience. But it's nothing that we want you to rush out and deploy right now until we really get our heads around the prescriptive guidance in terms of sizing and client impact. But if you want to turn it on and play with it in your environment and you have the requirements, which would be Exchange 2013 SP1 and Outlook 2013 SP1, then I would go ahead and check it out. The only other thing that I would say is that the system requirements for deploying Exchange 2013, right now we only require .NET Framework 4.5. but that's just to deploy Exchange. If you are using MAPI over HTTP, we actually require you to have .NET 4.5.1 installed. But we don't tell you that during setup. You'll only find that in the documentation. Yes. Well, we don't tell you that during setup because this is a feature that you can turn on afterwards. And we don't know that you're going to turn it on. And we don't want to force you into deploying code, prerequisite code, for something that you might not use. So we went around quite a bit about this within the team, and we decided we're not going to make this a hard prerequisite setup because it's something that you can activate after the fact. We are going to document it, so if you read the MAPI over HTTP documentation, it tells you in plain text, you need this update for this feature to work. So just keep that in mind. All right. I think this gentleman would like to leave, so I think we're done here. And my time is up anyway. Now, I am happy to take questions afterwards. And, of course, there's my email address. Please do feel free to send me any questions that you have. I'm happy to help any way I can. So with that, thank you very much for coming. And I hope you enjoy the rest of Tech Days. And if you have anything further, I'll just be packing up here for the next few moments. And don't forget to fill out your surveys. Thank you. Yeah.